Sorry about that. And the humidity stands at 62%, wind west from the 3 miles per hour. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes past eight, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I think we are beginning this week in very exciting fashion because we have with us Dr. John Swallow, who is the president of Carthage College, and Dr. David Timmerman, who is the provost of Carthage College. And they are joining me today to talk about the state of affairs at Carthage, and in particular, the plans that are being laid for the fall semester. And of course, those are plans that are being formulated in the midst of an unprecedented pandemic and the unprecedented and unanticipated challenges of COVID-19. And we, of course, have three institutions of higher learning here in the Kenosha-Racine area, but in many respects, Carthage faces a particularly complicated challenge since so much of the student body, the vast majority of the student body, is expected to live on campus. There is on-campus housing at UW Parkside as well, and of course, really not at all in terms of gateway. So the three institutions are facing three unique challenges, and we're, in a sense, starting with the most complicated challenge facing Carthage in terms of how to best and safely function during COVID-19. So that's where we're starting. We will eventually get updates from Gateway and from UW Parkside as well. But in the meantime, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dr. John Swallow and Dr. David Timmerman. Welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be back with you.
Great to be here, Greg.
Glad we can have this conversation. I wonder if I could hear from both of you the extent to which what you are dealing with now in your respective positions is, first of all, completely unprecedented in your academic careers, and also probably the stiffest and most complicated challenges that each of you have faced in your careers. Let's begin with President Swallow.
Sure, I was reflecting a bit on July 1st, that this was the beginning of my fourth year at Carthage. I was thinking about what had happened. I was thinking about the search committee that talked to me in April and May of 2017. And I was kind of joking to myself that, you know, they didn't mention a whole bunch of things that I was going to have to wrestle with when I got to Carthage. Everything seemed so excellent and everything was running perfectly and the future was entirely bright. But of course, 2020 wasn't on anyone's radar. No, I think this has been the most challenging period of my career, certainly as an academic administrator. More things coming at us at once, over which we have less and less control. The economy, public health, all these things really coming together in, yes, an unprecedented way, but also in combination. Means that all the typical playbooks that they give you when you go to a new president school or something else just don't seem to apply.
Provost Timmerman, would you second that comment about your own career and the dimensions of the challenges you've been facing with this?
Oh, most definitely. I had opportunity just yesterday to talk with a friend from my former institution, and one of the things I described for them was a feeling I had when we first went to remote teaching and learning at Carthage, which was in March. And there was a instinct I had that I'm now a full-time administrator, but I had this instinct that I wish there was a part of me that wished I could do that too, that I had taught so long in the way that so many of our faculty have person to person for decades. My first day in a liberal arts college was 1994 for me as a faculty member. And I remember having this urge, like, this is so dramatically different than everything our faculty have done. They spent their lives teaching face-to-face, using technology, of course, in various ways at various times, but to go completely to that distant, remote teaching and learning overnight. I just remember being baffled. And I, in many ways, Greg, I still am. I'm still amazed that we did that. And I know that we're spending time this summer getting better and better at that. I would have never predicted it. I don't think anybody could have. And I'm proud of our faculty for the way they threw their shoulder to the wheel and did it.
Hmm. President Swallow, one of the things that is particularly intriguing about what we are experiencing is that it's not like Carthage suffered some catastrophe limited to our campus. One of our dorms didn't fall in the lake or something, and then we have to sort of pick up the pieces and figure out how to go on. This is, in a sense, a catastrophe, in terms of organizationally and so on, that has befallen every institution of higher learning across the country and around the planet, for that matter. I assume that really changes the nature of how you are thinking about this, and also the means that are available to you in terms of trying to do some of the things that other institutions of higher learning are also doing. How unique is Carthage's situation? I mean, how applicable are the practices that are being developed, for instance, at other institutions? And how much communication are you having with your fellow college presidents across the country?
Well, a great deal of communication. And this is one of the ways in which it's so great to be in higher education, because it's such a sharing community. I've been in contact with Debbie Ford and Brian Albrecht. I've been in contact with fellow CCIW presidents. Yes, it's an athletic conference, but it's really a collection of similar schools with similar goals, private institutions. And so that's been a great group to work with. And then we've had conversations in the 18 institutions in and around Milwaukee, what we now call the Higher Education Regional Alliance. And all of that sharing has been helpful. It certainly doesn't mean that all campuses will do the same thing. Just as you pointed out, Gateway doesn't have a residential program, and we are mostly residential. And so the individual circumstances are different, and so some of the solutions may be different. But in many cases, we face a lot of similar challenges. We all want to preserve social distancing. We all want to make sure our faculty and staff are safe. We all want to make sure that we are meeting the expectations of students and parents. All of those things are very similar. And the sharing is good because I think, as we all know, from week to week, the pandemic evolves. And that means that the outbreak and its severity evolves. And it means the expectations of people locally and regionally evolve. And so we do make plans for the fall, and we do look at other institutions to see how they're doing it. But we also have to recognize that there may be a wave of changes again, depending on what is out there. And so we have to stay flexible on that point, yeah. Which is an interesting challenge. Everyone wants certainty, and I do too. And if someone will give me certainty about the fall, I will be as certain as we can be about Carthage's response. But we've used the best information we can, in concert with a lot of thinking at other schools, to develop the best plans we can, given what we know today.
Very good. I do want to have us spend most of our time with the fall and beyond, but Provost Timmerman, I want to give you a chance to talk a bit about Carthage finishing out this recent academic year. And you've already touched on the fact that it was no small matter to shift the means by which we deliver education. It sort of felt like overnight, although it wasn't quite overnight, but in very short fashion. I just wonder if you could just say a word about how you viewed that transition and how well you think it went, and to whatever extent it did in fact go well. Why did it go well, or what were the key ingredients to that success?
Oh, thank you. You know, with President Swallow, the executive staff during that time was looking at an article that described how good organizations, great organizations, respond to dramatic disruption. And one of the graphs it had was that great organizations, right after that moment of impact, enters into a heroic stage where everyone just immediately binds together and does whatever it takes to help the organization survive and thrive through it. And so I think we saw that in an incredible way with the faculty and staff at Carthage. There was just an immediate binding together and focus on what's best for the students. The faculty did something, you know, it's rare to see, which is within about a week, they changed the grading policy for the spring. And Greg, your listeners know you're a longtime faculty member as well as many other things. So you know well how long a faculty can debate and deliberate upon even the smallest thing. And that was actually a fairly big thing. And you say, well, changing the grading scheme, that's not that complicated. No, it is complicated. It's actually very complicated. There are a lot of things to take into account. And so that was just a wonderful thing to see. Gave me, I had a lot of pride in the faculty. And it was also one of those things, the president gets to say this a lot, I kind of feel like I rarely do, that all just happened and I had nothing to do with it. And I loved every second of it. And I mean, I want to have that experience again, by the way. But so that was great to see. And then almost as we were right getting toward the end, the other thing that impressed me about the Carthage faculty is we were getting close to the end. There began to be the shift to, now what are we going to do this summer to be better prepared for the fall? And again, I was right at about the point that I thought as provost, well, maybe I need to, you know, start pushing on this rock. The rock was already rolling. Mm. So that was great to see.
Very good. President Swallow, you had a hand, of course, in the shaping of a virtual commencement exercise that beamed all over the world in late May. And that, of course, is the way commencement exercises occurred in pretty much every college and university. And then Carthage had another day where some diplomas were handed out. Tell our listeners about that day.
I thought that was a wonderfully creative idea, and I start by really feeling the disappointment of our students that this was the graduation that they would face, and I've wanted to make sure that we continue to commit to bringing people back for ceremonies next year as we can to make that experience as full as possible. But given that we couldn't do that in May, it was great to have the virtual commencement and also to have. Well, it was really kind of a drive-by diploma pickup. We had lots of faculty and staff cheering on Campus Drive, dressed in their regalia. I was able to stand, this was kind of a remarkable achievement of our communications office. Cameron, my wife, and I were able to stand so that when a car came by, a photographer would be able to take a picture that included the student in the car and Cameron and me, and the Lincoln statue in the back, all at the same time, supposedly in focus. So I thought this was an enormous achievement. It was kind of funny that not all the families knew that this was coming. And so sometimes a parent would be in the passenger seat or the driver's seat and not want to be in the picture. And so the seat back went way down out of the picture, and then the picture could be just the perfect one they wanted.
Where we were standing as faculty, we didn't get to see that little sideshow. So I guess you had the best seat in the house for that. And fortunately, Mother Nature, who was very threatening earlier in the day, decided to clear out the rain just in time for all of that fun. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dr. John Swallow, president of Carthage College, and Dr. David Timmerman, who is provost of Carthage. We've just now been talking about the finishing up of this previous academic year. And now it's time to talk about how Carthage is hoping to move ahead and what is going to be involved. First of all, President Swallow, maybe you could give us a sense of the various groups that have been deployed to tackle some of these really complicated questions, and then we'll start talking about some of the recommendations and or answers that that they were able to craft. But what sort of teams have been on the ground over the last few weeks working on some of these most important questions?
We had two teams really working hard on this. So the two teams were at two different levels. So one was a small group that I appointed called the Operational Scenario Planning Group. This was headed up by Kimberly Goldsberry, our Vice President for Student Affairs and Dean of Students, and Ed Montanaro, an economist and Spanish professor. And I have to say that the two of them together, between all of the student life concerns and an economist who used to actually work for the Florida legislature, someone who loves statistics, someone who loves models, who loves reading the literature. And then we really put together a dream team, including Andrea Henley, Associate Professor of Biology, Mary Duckworth, our registrar, Ted Ferris, our AVP in Facilities Management, Herschel Kruger, our Chair of Theater. So if you start thinking about this, a lot of the arts programs are going to have to consider how they come back. And then, of course, Kelsey Peterson, our interim AD. So their job was to spend only a month thinking about different ways, different scenarios for the fall and how we would respond to each of them. What if there was an outbreak early? What if there was an outbreak late? What if testing became more available? What if testing was not available? And play all of those out in order that we learn the best that we could from each of them. I'm a big fan of scenario planning. I think you do learn a lot. And sometimes you find that regardless of scenario, you would do the same thing. Well, that's kind of comforting to know. Or if there are something that you would do really differently depending on two different scenarios, then that reminds you that there are some real decision points and can clarify that. So they did some great work. At the same time, we have all sorts of faculty and staff across the campus that you might think of as boots on the ground that think daily about all sorts of details. Where's the hand sanitizer gonna go? How many times a day should this space be cleaned? And so we really wanted to accumulate all that information and questions in one place. And so that was called our emergency management team, about 30 people. So there was a lot of time and effort spent bringing together all of those details. And something that's been interesting in my own mind is to recognize that, it's time for the emergency management team really not to meet so often anymore. And then because when they meet, they should prepare for a new emergency. This is not an emergency anymore. This is just the way life is. And so it needs to become part of our regular operations for the next 6 to 18 months, however long this takes. And so even organizationally, it was an interesting exercise to think about when an emergency begins and ends. So we're now transitioning from those groups to what will be a new group, smaller, focused on monitoring how well our protocols are going, including public health campaigns for students and faculty and staff. How is everyone complying? Do we need to change signage? Do we need to increase a kind of level of spirit and camaraderie over this? And so that's going to be a different purpose for that group, really to monitor and maintain us through the year to come.
When it comes to scenario planning, one is, of course, if I understand it correctly, you're developing actually a plethora of plans, each plan designed for a given scenario when you don't know what the scenario is ultimately going to be on July 1st or August 1st or September 1st. When one is engaged in scenario planning, how detailed do each of those plans need to be? And is there something in a sense kind of self-defeating about being too detailed? And on the other hand, is it dangerous to have plans that aren't detailed enough, that are too vague? Is there a magical happy medium where all of that makes sense?
Deep question, Greg. I would say in my own thinking about scenario planning, you want to iterate several times, maybe 4, maybe 8 times, and establish some parameters that are pretty different for each one. And then really, this is an imaginative and contemplative exercise. Really put your mind in the world that would be the case if those parameters were like that. So, I mean, just to take one as an example, suppose the recovery, the economic recovery is more like a U. There's high unemployment through the year to come. And let's suppose there's no vaccine for a year. So just making those assumptions and then playing out all the things that will happen, you know, politically, economically, what will likely happen to families, what their concerns will be, what our employees' concerns will be. Just putting yourself in that world. It's not always the first conclusions that you come up with that are so interesting, because some of them may seem more obvious, but it's the one later after you really inhabit that world, sort of like being a novelist. You inhabit that world for a while and you go, oh, yes, okay, so there would be these other consequences. But at the same time, having said that and delving deeply, I think in terms of a practical matter, going beyond 4 or 6 or 8 is probably not worth it. You've probably uncovered all that you're going to. You might want to return to the exercise anyway, but at a certain point, if the parameters get so far out of what's expected, it starts to feel like science fiction.
Hmm. Provost Timmerman, the report of the recommendation of the operating scenario planning group included something that I don't want to say was a surprise to me, but something I had not thought about at all. The group in this document calls it a significant constraint, that being Carthage is not accredited as an online degree-granting institution. I wonder if you could explain to our listeners what those innocent-sounding words mean and the ramifications in terms of kind of shaping how Carthage would go on from here.
Oh, certainly, yeah. So, Dan, there might be time to talk about the calendar we plan to use this fall and also our plan for teaching, although I might get into that. So our accrediting body makes a distinction. It's a very logical distinction. When is a program or degree you're offering to be considered a distance education program? That's commonly referred to as an online program. So I think most people now understand an online program to be a program you would take. You'd never, you know, conceivably have to leave your home, and you'd never have to set foot on the campus to get that degree. That would be a distance education program, an online program. And that accrediting body indicates that certain requirements for it to be considered such, mostly that more than 50% of the instruction occurs online. And it's true, we're not accredited to offer such programs. We're seeking that accreditation right now as we speak, but we do not have it currently. We have the ability to offer online, fully online courses, but not a full program. But the truth is, Greg, that report sort of misspoke technically on this point, because all institutions that I'm aware of in the United States, and I believe there are about 4,000 institutions of higher education in the spring, and to an extent this fall, have had to do some measure of fully distance education. And what we've been required to do, and we did it 3 times, I think, so far, is to notify our accrediting body that we were doing this due to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so what HLC, our accrediting body, has done with us, and I know from colleagues at other institutions, with all the other institutions I know of, is to grant a waiver during these days for this type of instruction. Mm-hmm. And so right now, as I think you know, we're planning to be in session and in person in the fall. But we do have that still in place with HLC as an exception due to the pandemic. Because what we also anticipate is that there will be some number of faculty who, due to their own health situation, will not be able to teach in person safely. And so they will need to teach remotely. And then it won't surprise, I don't think, any of us or any listener that we could have students in that situation, either due to underlying health conditions or because they themselves could contract the virus. this fall and need to be quarantined and recover from it if they become significantly ill from it. So we're planning a strategy where all of that is possible, meaning most students on campus and in classrooms and labs and studios and rehearsal halls in person, to the extent that that can take place safely with social distancing and masks, but also the ability to move to remote teaching and learning if necessary. And so, and I can talk more about that. We have a specific philosophy and practice we're calling adaptive course design to make that possible.
Very good. President Swallow, maybe you could explain before we get into the details of the fall, in a sense, why it, and I know there are several reasons why it was important to whatever extent it was possible to do this safely, to move back at least towards in-person on-campus delivery of education. And of course, some of those reasons have to do with the institution itself, and some of those have to do with the hopes and dreams and wishes of our students. But could you kind of outline that for us?
Sure. So Carthage provides that in-person transformative undergraduate education that our students and families seek and really expect. And so it's been difficult for them to imagine until they experienced it, what it would be like to have remote education. So why are they interested in the in-person experience? Well, it's because an in-person environment provides those opportunities for faculty and students to get to know each other well, for students to get to know each other well, to have the kind of conversations that you want to have as you're growing and developing and intellectually and personally between the ages of 18 and 22. However, I think we've all realized that there are also some things that are just, while relationships can be built online, and if I already know a professor, I might be able to have an excellent experience in a remote way, maybe, you know, for a whole semester. There are some things that simply can't happen well online. So one would be a football game. One would be a theater performance. There are some things that just sort of require low distance because that's part of the human experience there. And so I think we've all come to appreciate those more and more. I mean, I've heard choirs on Zoom in all those little boxes at the same time. And, you know, I think it's great that we can do that, but it's just not the same feeling as being in the chapel, hearing everyone sing in person. And so I think the nuances of this have changed a bit in recognizing all of the power of a residential education, but it really comes down to that personal connection where we believe learning happens best and most powerfully. That is why our students want to return and our faculty and staff want to return to be with them.
Very good. So a very carefully crafted plan has been recommended for the fall, which might make that possible. And one of the things that had to be altered, I think Provost Timmermans already touched on this, is an alteration of the calendar of when things begin, of when things change, and so on. So that would be a great place to start in terms of the specifics. And whichever one of you wants to tackle the explanation of the calendar, be my guest.
Oh, go ahead, David.
All right, very, very good. So President Swallow mentioned a bit ago about higher education being very collaborative institution to institution. And so there was an article that came out late March, I think, where colleagues had imagined 15 different ways to do education in this era. And I know a lot of provosts that I've spoken to read that article, used it. And then over time, as maybe isn't surprising, as things became more clear, as different people talked and spoke and deliberated about the different possibilities, the model we came to is actually fairly common in terms of schools choosing it. And it's based on the idea that reducing the amount of time by a few weeks on either end of this, or especially on the back end of the semester, is probably wise. And so we've got a calendar that will end in-person teaching and learning the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Couple of reasons for that. Some people think there will be a spike as we get a deeper into winter. Also, it's just been the case for those of us who've been on these campuses for a couple of decades. Students often come back from Thanksgiving sick as it is now. That's just kind of a fairly common thing to have happen. And so those two things tied together caused us to want to complete in-person teaching that Tuesday. There'll still be a week of classes that will be done remotely and then final exams. And then to make that happen and still have enough days, we've reduced our fall break and taken out a few other places where there was some room. And then we're starting a week early as well. But that first week will be done remotely. It's really just 3 days that week. It's not a full week. And then the move-in for students who are residential, which is about 70% of our students, and we have 2,600 students, so it's a lot of students, that move-in is going to be done in a much more extended path, adding multiple days to it so that freshmen come in over several days and then upperclassmen over several days, just because that will allow for social distancing even in that move-in process. And of course, some of that happens anyway. Our athletes come in a bit earlier, some of our music groups come in earlier and different things. And so that'll also help us in that regard.
So in other words, you're trying to avoid the scenario of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students and their parents crowded into hallways, going back and forth from dorms to cars, crowded into a few hours by spreading out the process of moving into campus. It makes it more possible for people to demonstrate the physical distancing that is so crucial in all this.
Yes. And then if you think about Thanksgiving break being a time where all those students go scattered back out to the winds and go all over the globe, right? When you have 2,600 students, you know, if we had a little, put a GPS on each of them and saw where they went, I think we'd be shocked. I'm sure they go all over the globe. And then bring all of that back on campus, we didn't think that was the wisest thing. And again, where we've come to is actually a fairly commonplace colleges. Many colleges have come to on this.
Fascinating. So logistically, that moving in process, will that involve students being assigned to a particular window of time and or requesting a particular window of time versus just showing up with their stuff whenever it's convenient for them?
Yes. And interestingly, so I think, one of the fun times on college campuses actually is that move-in, because often on the move-in, you know, it's mom and dad and their aunt and a couple friends and the brothers and sisters and, you know, groups of six people move one student in with more things than you could probably, you know, imagine, lots of loads. And so, that's going to be different this year. I believe each student may have one other person helping them move things in, actually going into the residence halls, and there will be a time, and it will be spaced out, different groups, kind of like the way some airlines load an airplane, right? Mm-hmm. So that will be different.
President Swallow, there's usually a new student orientation, and then a convocation, a big event that very much officially welcomes the incoming freshmen to campus. Will there be a big event like that, or is that deemed to be unwise at this point?
Yeah, my understanding today is our thinking is that that's unwise. We may want to break it up into several where people can be more distanced. But to have large events and, you know, in our most meaningful spaces, it's going to be a real disappointment not to have them. But like everything else, it might be that having multiple orientations, multiple meetings of, let's say, the president with students could be more intimate. It might have its own appeal. I'm often interested in how some of the changes that we go through this year may reveal some ways in which we might be more excited to do it the new way than the old way.
Interesting. Provost Timmerman, I think one of the challenges that you are probably facing in terms of the implementation of the plan for the fall has to do with the physical distancing that we hope can be achieved in various classrooms. And the fact that if you don't have a bunch of students crammed into a classroom to full capacity, then what do you do with those students? Or where do you put them? How do you find room to teach courses when that matter of distancing is so significant? Tell us more about just how complicated a challenge that is and how that challenging problem is being met.
Yes, very good. So, well, we're in the middle of the plans for it, but so a general principle we've come to is that in any given space, we're probably looking at no more than 50% of the stated capacity. So if we've got a classroom where it holds, we've said it holds 24 students, we're probably going to say that that should only have 12 students in it at any given time. There are some caveats to that because it also has to do with the way the room's set up. And so right now, with that principle that the scenario planning group came out with, it's in that report that you've been referring to, and it's common sense and it's you know, national. We've been going course by course, class by class, because as you know, and I'm sure listeners know, an art studio is different than a science lab, is different from a lecture class, is different from a seminar class. And all the different rooms across the campus are of varying sizes. And then it also depends on the specific enrollment for a particular class. So we set out these general principles about distancing and class capacities, classroom and studio capacities. But at the moment, what we're doing is divisional deans, the registrar, and department chairs are literally looking class by class, course by course, speaking with the instructor, looking at the setup, thinking about alternatives. And so that's what's happening right now as we speak, literally. And so some of the ideas include the things you may have read about, such as plexiglass screen in front of the clear plexiglass in front of the instructor, and the instructor needing to stay behind that. Also, classes that might have a half the students in person one day a week and the other half a different day of the week, and the other students participating remotely. So these are the sorts of things that we're working on. Different challenges in different areas. Your area, Greg, is particularly challenging. One of the primary ways COVID spreads is through the voice, the human voice. And you do a great job teaching a lot of students how to sing, and I'm sure you teach them to sing loudly and proudly. And we just simply don't need them doing that, not very well, not close to each other. So that's going to look differently than an art studio, than a lecture class. So what I've said is we've got these basic principles, but the music professor and the science professor know best. And so let's take these principles and apply them with a nuance and understanding and expertise in consultation with the faculty members. But that's a lot of that's a lot of deliberation. That's a lot of conversation. And so we're engaged in that right now.
That probably makes you grateful that it's early July right now and not early August.
It's so true.
Right. President Swallow, maybe you could address some of the other issues that have to do with living safely in the era of COVID-19 in terms of what will be required of, I was going to say students, but faculty and staff as well, of course, in terms of what will be strongly suggested versus absolutely required in terms of how people are to conduct themselves on campus during this period of COVID-19.
We're starting with the idea that we need a unified public health campaign on campus, and we've called it Stay Safe Carthage. There'll be a hashtag because we want to think of this not simply as a set of rules and protocols, but really as a community spirit around keeping each other safe. So we will require masks. We won't require masks 24/7. We're not gonna require that you wear a mask when you're sleeping, for instance, but in public spaces, inside buildings, in hallways, when you are not more than 6 feet away from someone else, then masks will be required. Now, that can vary. If you're behind a plexiglass, then that's less significant. So we will work on this. As we've had our employees, faculty, and staff coming back this summer from remote work, we've been, understanding how that works. Like I said, on one hand, we don't want to feel like this is incredibly punitive and that we have people walking around pointing fingers. On the other hand, it is very important to a lot of the people on campus that we do practice a safe social distancing so that they will feel safe on campus. Mm-hmm. And so there's a balance to be achieved there, both with positive incentives and then with some negative corralling when needed. Mm-hmm. That's frankly, I'm glad that we have the summer to work on this, because this is another aspect of human behavior. I think this is something that all of society is trying to think through. How can we all, in a positive spirit, but in an effective way, encourage people to work together to be safe? So I think we're going to get there without much trouble with our faculty and staff, because I think we have that kind of bonding that David mentioned earlier. We all really do want to do a good and heroic job. And then if we can serve as good models for students as they come in groups, again, spaced out, day by day at the beginning of the semester, we're hoping to acculturate them into this new approach. Mm.
Provost Timmerman, I know that one thing that has been stated very clearly to the faculty is that if a given faculty person has concerns about doing their teaching in person, that there are provisions by which they can make arrangements for themselves. Can you just tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, so, right, we're a community, faculty, staff, and students, and we're concerned about the health of all of us. That's our bedrock principle. And so, yes, the way we're handling it right now is back through that. In terms of the faculty, the staff is a similar process through supervisors, but just for the moment, thinking of the faculty, we're working through department chairs, deans and department chairs. And so those conversations are taking place like just this week with individuals reaching out. And we're trying to get a sense of some of these things as we head into the fall. That could have an impact, right? If a faculty member is in a compromised situation, we need to plan for that, communicate that out to students, and then make plans on from the registrar's perspective, because maybe different classrooms are open now that weren't before. Maybe something else can happen in that space than happened otherwise. It's a large logistical task with a lot of details that are all interrelated, but it all goes back to we love our faculty and our staff and students, and we want to keep all of us safe during this time.
Amen. President Swallow, we've touched already on some of the unique challenges that are special challenges, at least, that are facing the performing arts. What I want to ask you about is something I know a little less about, namely athletics. And of course, that's also something that we don't call it an audience, but in a sense, it's a different kind of theater, whether, it's out on the football field or whatever. What is the plan at the point, or at this point, there is a plan still being formulated in terms of whether or not athletic competition can happen in the fall, at least to some extent?
Well, Carthage has been working closely with our CCIW conference partners on that very question. The NCAA has itself provided some what they call resocialization guidelines as really a starting point, but it's going to come down to school by school and conference by conference. The CCIW is excited to bring sports back, has convened two committees across the many schools to think about the health and safety of athletes, what sort of performance schedules may need to change. But also it recognizes, and frankly, it's still being worked out, the enormous variety of interactions that occurs even under what you think of as athletics. So for instance, golf, I think, can proceed pretty easily. I think it's already happening on golf courses today. I think we understand how to do that safely and with social distancing. football, and then let's just say wrestling, it would be at the other extreme. You have two people very close together for an extended period of time. So we will all have to work through that. What's important also to think about here is that we, of course, can only have an athletic program with contests if there are opponents. You can't really do this by yourself on a campus unless you want to call it intramurals. So it really does depend on some of the decisions that others make. And then finally, not to overcomplicate it, but our conference is spread out, since it's the College Conference of Illinois and Wisconsin, with a number of schools in different places in Illinois, including one in Chicago, and then some of us in Wisconsin, and the various local restrictions are different. And so we may actually host games here at Carthage that couldn't be played because at an institution in Chicago. So all of these things are needing to be worked out. Everyone's very interested, and I would say hopeful, optimistic, and planning to return to an athletic program. But many, many details are still to be worked out.
Wow. Provost Timmerman, the last I heard, we had a lot of students planning to enroll at Carthage, to begin their education at Carthage in the fall, in fact, in record-breaking numbers. What can you tell us about what those numbers look like right now?
They still look incredibly good. And what's interesting, I had this thought very early on that, and I have two sons, I love them dearly. They're now in their late, one's in his late 20s, one's in his early 30s. But I had the thought, you know, if they were to come home, I would love them and it would be great. But I would imagine that after a bit, it would be very difficult, both for them and for me. And so I had a thought early on in this COVID era that there might start to develop a pent-up desire among many young people to, like, go somewhere else than their parents' house or their parents' basement. And so I kind of wonder if we're seeing that at Carthage College, because you're exactly right, Greg. We still are looking at record numbers for first-time freshmen and potentially record number for transfer students. So I happen to believe there is that desire out there, and I'm glad for it. We have a great thing. Being on a residential liberal arts college like Carthage is a fantastic experience. So, but as the president has mentioned, there is still a lot of uncertainty. But looking at the numbers, it's still the case. We're up over 100 students from year to year from last fall, and we're looking at a record number of students.
Wow. And now we get to figure out how to teach them all. And an interesting and in some respects, in a strange sort of way, an almost exhilarating challenge.
Thank you. I think that's a great word for it. It is exhilarating in its way. And why? Well, because we love what we do so much. We love our students. Yes, we still love what we do, and we still love our students, even in the middle of a pandemic.
President Swallow, 30 seconds for a final word.
We're so happy to have the support of local businesses and hospitals and municipalities in working through this crisis. I mean, I've been very pleased to be a part of the Kenosha Kickstart plan happening. And I would say that that's valuable advice. And really, the more that we all band together as a community, then we really will be able to manage our way through the pandemic. It's when we do things at cross purposes that it's not so good. So I'm just so pleased that Carthage is here in such a strong community.
President John Swallow, Provost David Timmerman, I appreciate both of you joining me today on The Morning Show, making time for this conversation in schedules I can't imagine being more busy than they are right now. So thank you so much for allowing this conversation to take place, and best wishes to both of you.
You too, Greg. Thank you.
You too, Greg. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my conversation with J. Chester Johnson, the author of a remarkable memoir called Damaged Heritage. It tells the story of a horrific outbreak of racially motivated murders in rural Arkansas in early September 1919, those killings known collectively as the Elaine Race Massacre. J. Chester Johnson had to somehow come to grips with the fact that his own grandfather was a participant. The story, though, is also of how he met and became very dear friends with a descendant from some of the victims of that massacre. Again, the book is Damaged Heritage. We talk tomorrow. Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackanddrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including